And this is a, on the practical aspects of the computation in your lab. And I think we all agree now, at least for single particle work, that the computation is almost as important as the microscope. So we have three speakers. Holger will discuss his lab, which I understand is a very well-equipped lab computationally. And then Dan Southworth will talk about what you can do if you're starting out. And then Steve Ludke will give you the blue sky approach if you have $1 million or $2 million to spend on computation. So I'll turn it over to Holger.
Okay. I apologize for having disturbed your well-deserved coffee break. But my flight is right now, and I made a mistake in booking the flight. So it's all my mistake, so blame me. These were the good old times. So, 20 years ago, this is when I, it was close when I started to do my PhD. So I did my PhD on a DEC Alpha computer, which was one of the most fancy computers at the time. And you see, it was a 46-bit. It were the first 64-bit RISC processors, and running at a 200 megahertz. And I was so proud that I had a 4 gigabyte disk on my own. So this is my whole PhD thesis was on a 4 gigabyte disk. We had to share this thing. So we were three people running projects on one of those computers. So now, you can't imagine these things. And it also shows how quickly computers have developed. So way faster than detectors, way faster than microscopes. So while you can still use a 20-year microscope and a 20-year-old CCD camera maybe even as well, it's still not as outdated as a 20-year-old computer. So this is then the problem we had to we had to find answers for this problem that once we had our Titan cryos, you can calculate how many images can produce every day. And now with these movies, it's even more because you have a multiplication factor depending on what camera you're using. So how do you actually deal with the amount of images that you get from a Titan cryos in terms of computational means? So you don't want to have all the images that you record on stock and nobody does anything with them. I mean, this is useless. You want to have enough computational speed to keep up with what comes out of your Titan cryos if it runs normally. So there is a problem with respect to storage, as we all know and have heard about, the computational speed, but also data transfer and how well such a system is equipped for multi-user compatibility. So this is then the system I would quickly like to show you, because this is what we have now recently installed and what I think we can now use it, and it's sufficient to deal with all the images that we get from our microscope. This is a 4-rack system, so we have 4 of these racks here. Those are air-water cooled racks because we have a GPU-CPU cluster, and if you have a high density of GPUs in your cluster, then there's a lot of heat being produced because, sheer compute density in a mixed GPU-CPU cluster is way higher than in a CPU cluster alone. And so we decided to have an air-water cooling system, so it's very similar to your microscope. So we generate cold air with the in-house water cooling system. And so each rack can carry away 30 kilowatts of heat that is almost the amount of heat that is generated by this system. And we watch all our computers with a system, with a Nagios system. So we have a light here, which is a former DDR light. So if it's green, all our computers are okay, and all hard drives are okay. If it's red, then there's something going wrong. What is this system? What does it consist of? So the whole cluster hardware that we have in here is, we have 80 nodes of a system that looks like that is 2 unit height in height. So it's a super micro board. We have 128 gigabyte of RAM on each of the systems. We have 250 gigabyte hard drive. There's two Intel Xeon CPUs on all of them, and we have an InfiniBand card for the networking, so I come back to that later, and we have three NVIDIA Tesla GPU compute cards in each of those nodes, and we have 80 of them, and for the networking, we have the InfiniBand cards and 8 InfiniBand switches, so you can set up the networking in many different ways, and I will also come back to that in a minute. And we have a 1.1 petabyte file system that is based on the Fraunhofer file system, which is now called BGFS, which we found the most powerful file system if you really have to transfer a lot of data and not just doing storage or long-term archiving. This is a very good file system. Okay, why do we have a GPU cluster? So we have a GPU cluster because the compute density that you can put into such a system is way higher than just for CPUs. In our institute, we have not enough room for building huge clusters, so this was a way to just increase the computational speed per space in the institute. But it's also very economic in terms of energy requirements, so you get basically more speed for electricity power than you do for CPUs. And this is the latest NVIDIA card. It's called Kepler K20, and you see it has many stream processors. It has now a 5 gigabyte memory, and those things are very fast. They have improved a lot over the last couple of years. There's always new generations of these cards, which makes it a bit difficult to keep up in optimizing the software that you have. So in order to get the most out of it, of a GPU card, you can do it not in a simple way so that you just parallelize part of the code and then use the simple versions and just don't care about optimization. So that doesn't give you enough computational power to justify the use of GPUs. So if you have GPUs, unfortunately, there's a disadvantage that you really have to do continuous development on the software and take all the developments that NVIDIA does on making new GUIDA libraries and new features in this GUIDA system, so that you can really get most out of the GPU card. So that is a very different kind of programming. It requires special skills and it takes a lot of energy. So sometimes I'm not really sure whether it's a good idea to use GPUs. It certainly is if everything is running, because they are very stable. They are more heat tolerant, so they have a very long lifetime. So they are pretty good, but they are more dynamic in terms of how they develop over time. So you cannot use the same software and get the same speed increase with new generations of GPU cards. You always have to do some adaptation. So it's not necessarily the best idea to buy GPU clusters now, but maybe in the future. But there's also other accelerators, and Steve will talk about that, I think. So he will show, there's the talk about the Intel C and other options you have to build your cluster. So we have this, and it works, but it's not easy. So we found the networking system quite important. So what we decided to buy is an InfiniBand system, and there's many different ways of how you can build this InfiniBand system. We try to keep it at a level that is still affordable, but really very fast. And what we have is a copper-based InfiniBand system that's called QDR. QDR stands for Quad Data Rate, and it's a fast way of getting data to your network, because you have more data that is transmitted per clock cycle than you have in a normal connection. And you see this is the time how, and the prediction how things will develop. So all these networking stuff will become more and more powerful over time. There's also already now there is InfiniBand that is based on light, so not on copper. So this is already faster. but it's also way more expensive. So we decided to go for this, and this gives you a data transfer rate of 40 gigabit, which is then even, at least four times better than what you get with a 10 gigabit network. And the way we set it up is that we have this very complicated switch set up. So you need these eight switches that we bought in order to really deal with these 80 nodes that we have in the cluster in a perfect manner. And the way it's set up means each node in our cluster can communicate to each other node in the cluster with 40 gigabit per second at any time. So this is how it's set up. The thing is that it's optimized for these 80 nodes. If you buy more nodes, it doesn't work anymore. Then you have to buy many more switches because it doesn't scale linearly. So, but this is a very efficient thing, and we can really get very fast data transfer rates. So when our system runs, we get under full load, if the whole cluster is under full load, we can still put data on it with a data transfer rate of more than 2 gigabytes per second. So this is very fast. So in order to keep track of a huge cluster, we bought this software, which we find quite useful. So it's called the Bright Cluster Manager. It's a system that runs under Red Hat derivative Linux. This is a very powerful software to just keep track of everything what's going on your cluster. And what we find very interesting is an option that really looks at the hard drives. And a hard drive that is about to die in the near future makes some weird signals. And this is being spotted by this system. So you can really detect hard drives that are no longer working well. But before they die, you can basically replace it. And that is very important if you have a setup where you have a huge system of more than a petabyte. You don't want to have a situation where many hard drives die at the same time and where you have to rebuild the whole file system. So this is something you definitely would like to avoid. And with some systems, some commercial systems that are out there, you can keep track of these things. So this is a very convenient system, actually. So that is the file system that we are using. As I said, it's a Fraunhofer system that is now called BGFS. It works in a way that you have the compute nodes, which are our 80 CPU, GPU nodes, and then you have storage servers where all our hard drives are in there, and you need metadata servers that deal with the information in a way that you have so-called chunks. So everything that is produced here, it's some parts of the data that are then stored randomly on those storage servers. So you have bits and pieces here and there. And the server that keeps track of where those things go are those metadata servers. So this is very good because you have many of those servers and you can write in parallel, read in parallel, and you need these metadata that keep track of it. And that means you get in overall, you get a dramatic speed increase of how the data is being transferred. And as I said, we can write at about 2 gigabytes per second right now. It can still be optimized, so this can be improved up to more than 3 gigabytes per second, depending on how you deal with it. And just to compare it, if you have a local hard drive, a modern hard drive can do about 160 megabytes per second on your normal computer. So we find this very reliable, and together with these Pride system, we can also keep track that if any of our hard drive is about to die, that this is not that this runs really stably. So I think that's about it. What I have to tell. That's it. So if you have questions, please.
Thanks. What?
Okay, go ahead.
Is the InfiniBand cost effective? I mean, for a lab that is really short on money, is that an option that is?
I mean, if you have such a system, you need at least a 10 gigabit network. So 1 gigabit network is clearly not sufficient. And what we figured out is that we had an older system with a gigabit network, and this was always clocked in a multi-user environment where people transfer a lot of data, and everything is then limited suddenly by the bandwidth of your network, and things slow down. So in this case, this doesn't happen at all. Whether a 10 gigabit system is good enough already, I can't tell because we don't have it. Most likely it is. If you calculate the numbers, it should be. But we don't know exactly whether. So we certainly didn't want to have any bottlenecks in our system, so we went for the InfiniBand solution. Uh-huh. I think a single card is about 130 or 40 euro for each of the nodes. And yeah, in here we had to buy them because it was a modular thing. And then you have to invest in the switches, so the switches and the cables. So it's a larger number of switches that you need.
For the GPU work, you use CUDA from NVIDIA. AMD processors or GPUs use OpenCL or something like that,
yeah.
And that's, I think, harder to program. Do you know, does that have a better long-term usability of the code, at least?
Yeah. What do you mean, if you can use it for both?
I think you can use it for both, but would it be easier to maintain software in OpenCL if it's a standard that is?
It could be, because it's more universal. We started in CUDA, and we still stick to CUDA at the moment, but it might be that OpenCL. You have
I can answer that maybe a little bit.
The problem with OpenCL is it tends to be a fair bit less efficient. CUDA really is very close to the hardware, and you can get a lot of. But I don't mean just a little bit. It could be like a factor of 4 or 5 in many cases. So OpenCL is better longer term, but it doesn't get you nearly as much out of the hardware.
Holger, can you talk a bit more about how you organize your file system? Like, is it all one big array visible as one disk that's always fast, always available, and so you don't have any, say, archive or anything?
No,
like
we
that?
We have an archiving system in our institute. So there's a robot. This is a general service in our institute, so you can just transfer everything to an archive, and they have a robot that eats everything that we.
My other question was still about CUDA. Like, is it really reasonable for, say, a starting lab or whatever to expect to be able to do this kind of maintenance? I mean,
No way.
That's what I thought. And then
there's simply no way.
Can we expect academic groups who write software to maintain these things?
It's really an investment, and I have a couple of people who have to take care about the code and optimize it now for these new cards. And also the servicing of such a cluster. We do that on our own, so we have no help from the institute. So it's an investment.
So I guess the meta question is it something as a field that we think is reasonable to expect?
There need to be other solutions. I mean, either needs to be somewhere in your institute, and some people have to take care, because I think not every group can deal with that. I mean, it's just not possible. But on the other hand, you need it at about this size. Maybe not exactly that, or even larger, I don't know. But if you have a Titan and you have all the data and you can't process it, it's also not good.
With your cluster and your storage servers, in regards to the location with the microscope, after listening to John's talk and hearing about how important sound and vibrations are with your data, where is this cluster in regards to your microscope? And if it is a further distance, if you don't have access something so far, I mean, your copper is very short distance. Have you looked into like fibers or?
Yeah, we have no really fast connection yet from the microscope to the cluster. So the cluster is maybe 30, 40 meters away from the microscope. And we have no solution yet for a very fast direct connection from whatever is being written out from this frame solution, which you have just set up a few weeks ago, so that we can put that directly onto the cluster. So we still have to figure out how we do that. But we don't have a solution yet for this. So we just write on local hard drive, and then we start the picking, and then it's everything on the cluster, which gives us an advantage that we have a like everybody probably, we have at least a backup on our small hard drive that we have before it gets lost somewhere. But it's not a good solution. I mean, certainly not.
Yeah. Holger, have you considered Luther instead of Fraunhofer? I understand it's about two orders of magnitude faster. It's distributed between the nodes in the in SSDs, right?
And yeah, we have tried when we did that. We have tried and studied a few file systems, and we found this the most powerful. Especially if you have really many people working on the cluster, you have always, I mean, you have constant access, massive access on data, and you have to shift them around. And we found this is the fastest, and it seems to be reliable. So we have no issues with it. I think it's also it's getting more and more popular. So I think Fraunhofer, as you find it, in also in many of these top 500 clusters now of the fastest supercomputers. I think it's very, very popular system.
All right, the Holger has to get to the airport. So let's give him a good hand.
Thank you very much.
Is that right? So this is kind of the high end to Dan is going to talk about what happens, what can you do when you're starting out?
The reality.
Sorry.
Thank you.
Okay, thank
So I don't have a lot of slides. I just figured this would probably be more of a discussion session for people because it's clearly a problem that isn't solved for us. But I've been at Michigan for about 3 years. And so, you know, at the beginning 3 years ago, we they invested a lot of money in developing a great EM facility. And then a year or two later, the DDD detectors came out and then that changed everything, and now we're in the process of sort of updating all the computational side of things, trying to figure out what to do. And I think, you know, one of the main considerations is really how many people and how much data are you outputting. And so, you know, for just sort of basic 1 to 2 labs, 5 to 10 people, you know, it's about how many people are on the microscope collecting data. And then how you can really facilitate the ability to grow to allow more people to join the lab or to collaborate with more people to generate more data. And I think, you know, sort of in part from what Holger mentioned, you know, having IT staff is really going to be is really important because along the way you're going to need to be able to write particular short software programs to be able to transfer data rapidly and move things around and really help support all of the computer infrastructure you have. So it's helpful to really, you know, look into institute support or departmental support to some extent of IT staff. We have several people at the institute that cover IT for the entire institute, and we just sort of suck up a good portion of their their time, as it turns out, because they are in fact interested in this equipment. They're interested in the GPU clusters, as opposed to, you know, trying to help solve somebody's email problem or something like that. So they are very interested in helping you out. So you know, really take advantage of whatever IT people you have. In terms of cryo facility, then what was already sort of discussed is really the importance of having sort of full-time research staff person there that can really help mediate between the microscope equipment and then the computer equipment. So our person who we share between the labs is really important for communicating with the IT staff and just setting up the detectors and collecting data. You know, and so everybody has their own sort of flavor now of how to correct collect the direct electron images. what we found in setting it up was that really sort of considering distances between the different processors and how far away things have to be if you want to collect data remotely, and then how far away the server room would have to then be to maintain sort of a type 10 gig type connection. And then so what we're coming across now is that generally with these movie mode images, that for each stack without the super resolution mode, we're looking at half the 1 gig per image or per stack, and then that in really high throughput times ends up being 1 to 2 terabytes per day, and that's just not even in the sort of super resolution type mode. So that's just a tremendous amount of data that you then have to deal with, and you want to be able to deal with it continually because you want to go back to the stacks and back to the movies and everything. So so generally after collection, we immediately go to a GPU machine for drift correction, and then this is all in sort of our server room where we have at this point a relatively small, more permanent storage setup of a couple hundred terabytes, and even for the two labs, I think we'll probably end up filling this up reasonably quickly. And so I think one of the main things to think about is really to make these sort of purchases in piecemeal, because you don't know what it's going to be like 5 years from now, and what will be required, and how much data will be needed, and then it's helpful to have sort of this level of expandability. So. So for us, we have a small CPU cluster that was installed about 5 years ago when they were setting up the facility, with about 160 cores, including also a head node. And both of those are actually now quite dated. And so while we can use them, they're not really optimal anymore for the amount of processing that we need to have. And so we just did invest in a small GPU cluster, and that's been really helpful in pushing the processing power of the facility. So, I think in terms of smaller setup, I think a small GPU cluster really is a good thing probably to shoot for, as opposed to, a $200,000 or $300,000 CPU cluster. What I also have found somewhat useful, and maybe Steve will be able to talk about it, is to be able to purchase a couple of these sort of lower-end processing servers where you have, I bought this just when I started, and so these are really minor in terms of the number of cores. But now you can get up to sort of 64 cores on these types of servers, for $10,000 to $20,000 investments. And it's helpful in sort of breaking up the processing where you have fewer users on a particular machine, and so if something breaks down or things need to be restarted, then you haven't lost a lot of computing time, basically, and they're reasonably cheap compared to a cluster, and they are quite fast. So a lot of our processing is 2D analysis, and it's RAM intensive, but it's not not necessarily processor intensive. And so some of these smaller servers have been really helpful in terms of being able to do all of the initial data processing. Visualizing and processing from for the users is really, up to how people want to set it up. This was discussed a little bit earlier, just in terms of personal workstations. We've gone sort of more iMac route. We do have some more higher end machines that people can process, locally if they really want to. Some people prefer having stuff set up as Linux boxes, which is not a huge investment either. Storage and backup is something we're really struggling with now. There is an institute-wide backup-to-tape system that has probably a total of about 300 terabytes in capacity. With it's nice in that it's two copies, one that's on-site and one that's off-site, so that's really fantastic. It's just that, that's probably enough for the CryoEM, two CryoEM labs, but it doesn't exactly cover everybody else either. So also when you're generating high amounts of data, 1 to 2 terabytes in a weekend of data collection, the daily backup becomes really hangs up on that. So we're not exactly sure what the best way to move forward in terms of storage and backup. But I think, and one of the things that we discussed earlier was that really just you don't necessarily need to back up everything. and that you keep stuff for a shorter period of time now and get rid of data that you're not going to really need for permanent long-term storage. Just in terms of answering questions that were on this topic, one of the questions was really, are these supercomputer centers of value? And so I think one of the issues that we have a sort of supercomputer center at University of Michigan, and we've looked into utilizing that for big processing of, you know, sort of final rounds of refinement to really improve resolution and everything. But it's just not set up properly, really, for cryo-EM data. There's often not enough RAM in the individual CPUs that are available, and then the rental costs aren't necessarily structured properly. So I think for us, it's something like $6 a CPU per month, and you get like maybe a terabyte of storage, because in general, that's not, you know, most people need a ton of storage for the general use of these things. And so so to move all of your data over there, and then to spend, you know, $600 to $1,000 for just 1 month of processing, and then move your data back, can be rather, you know, time-consuming and costly. You know, so you can't keep things over there that often. But I think there's other ways that universities have set these things up. You know, when I was talking to Justin, it sounds like University of Washington has a nice setup where you can invest in the architecture at these centers. And then that way you have control over what the types of CPUs are. You can buy them incrementally. You can have on-site storage if you need to have larger amounts of storage. So I think these, depending on how it's set up at particular places, you know, could be an advantage. And then even despite all this, you're going to still need to invest in some level of local computational equipment. One of the other questions was cloud computing. I don't know if anybody has any suggestions on that. I mean, I think just the transfer rates are going to be a problem, right? I mean, you know, transfer rates even within our own building is an issue for the amount of data that we're using. So you know, maybe in the long run it might be possible for archiving, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure if that's feasible. And then some of the other questions: what software do you need up and running? I mean, really, everything. I think, you know, it's important to be on top of this and to utilize all the software processing programs that you can, and, you know, go to these meetings and hear about the new software developments and test them out. You know, for us, we tend to use UCSF Image currently for data acquisition. This may shift, hopefully, to Legendon at some point. Drift correction, you know, we're using the motion core, but there are obviously other possibilities, and that will be evolving. And then a variety of different particle picking softwares. And then 2D classification, you know, Spider, old Spider scripts are still used in our lab. EMAN, even EMAN 1 is used, you know, a number of times. So we really kind of spread out the use quite a bit. I think it's good to really have everything really kind of available and to test it on different types of software. How do you then support the software and hardware? You know, sort of a Legendon Appian type way that is able to access all these different programs is useful. one possible downside is that will require, you know, heavy amounts of investment by IT support to really get that up and running, and really encourage users to use this type of method to use the sort of Legendon Appian pipeline. One thing that we have found is that this SVGrid setup that Harvard allows, where they basically maintain all of these programs in a package, and you just basically pay an annual amount. I think it's about $1,500 a year, has actually been really quite useful for us. It just saves a lot of time in having to install software on all the different machines and all the different computers around the lab. And so they sort of cover the support. They always generally update to the newest version, and then you have access to all the previous versions. So all the versions of Spider, you know, back to version 8 are available. And so while all these programs are generally free and you have to then pay for this level of support, I think it sort of made our IT people really quite happy that they don't have to really troubleshoot and deal with constantly updating and loading new software onto the different machines. So that's been one sort of reasonably good thing. And then again, support through your IT within the institute is good, just in terms of you will often need little pieces of software written in order to help data transfer and everything. And then obviously validation is important. This is one of the questions here, but we've discussed that earlier. And so I think just, you know, using a variety of different softwares to run your reconstructions is really important. In terms of our current bottlenecks, I think are really transfer rates, and that's at every step. Even in setting up the facility with the DDD camera, trying to measure distances as to where we can put the different computers and how far away things can be, installing 10 gig E sort of as everywhere that you can. And then for sort of backups and more long-term storage. And then we'd like to move to more sort of faster drift correction on the fly, so that when we're collecting images, we can relatively quickly look at the corrected images to know that particles are there and that it looks pretty good with high contrast. And then really the age of the different computers, because everything is sort of been bought in piecemeal, then you have to then replace everything in different steps. And so when do you do that, and how do you then sort of pay for it? So that's really it.
It's a question. Who else is having? Who else sees drift correction on the fly as a bottleneck? And what solutions do other people come up with?
Yeah, in my group in Basel, we have written a little GUI around the motion call, and it just sits and watches over the K2 computer. And as soon as you save a movie there, it's drift corrected in a pipeline. We call this 2DX Automator. It's downloadable from our website. Yeah, with the graphics card that Jifan Cheng's lab recommends.
You do that one first, and I'll take it.
With the K2 computer, are you using just the 10 gigabit network, or did you expand that computer to faster?
There was a bigger issue. So the K2 PC has maxed out its Ethernet connection, so we have installed an optical cable from that to the drift corrector PC, which also runs at 10 gigabit. That was the bottleneck, which now is not.
At UCSF, we have on the K2 PC, we put in a graphic card and K10, I think Tesla K10 into it, so we can do the on the fly, because the image was saved direct to the solid state drive. And we can do on-the-fly motion correction there. Also, had an interface similar like Hanin said. And then, but then we did this process right on the same machine as the K2 camera, K2 computer. Then there's a 10 gig fiber optic link from there to the server room. Then the image has been saved away. But then local process there. But you can process in another computer. And all you need to know is that the scenes can sort of like reflect back to the wherever you sit, and then you can see the results right away. So I actually had another different question that we often have people come to collecting data from other side, and then with this terabytes of data, what is the best way for them to take the data back? And then and they often think, oh, I can bring a US external hard drive for terabytes, is a USB to plug in, and take long time to copy 4 terabyte data into that thing.
Well, the sort of SCSI drive connections to the hard drives. I don't remember who had the image of all the stacks of hard drives that you have up. I mean, is that reasonably fast in terms of transfer just onto a portable hard drive?
It takes a long time to copy onto those drives. I think that's what Yifan's point was. You know, I mean, I don't know what it takes us, but forever it feels like. Yeah. We're spending days and days and days after the user leaves copying this darn data, you know, and then we send it off.
Don't know what is the best way, and then for the user and for the place that hosts them, And it's pain in the neck because you need to clean up all this data so that you can use disk space for the next data correction.
Just one thing about the external hard drive thing, you have to be careful because when people say external hard drive, they often mean, you know, just these USB 2, USB 3 drives. And even USB 3 drives tend to be a lot slower than if you get one of these docks, you know, right. You can plug into the computer via a higher speed connection and then just drop the drive in, and that can be substantially faster, but still it's limited by the rate of the drive.
Yeah, I don't know how many of you are aware, but there is something called Internet 2 now that runs at 100 gigabits per second, and it connects several nodes around the country and abroad. So you probably want to find out how well connected your center is and whether you can use access to that. Well, so the question is, you know, so for instance, in D.C. and Cincinnati and Chicago, they are all connected at that speed. We have a 100 gigabit token ring and a 10 gigabit connection. So that you have to find out. I mean, that what I'm trying to tell is, you know, so get information about what your center is, because you might be more connected than you think.
Yeah, I just wanted to say I've been FedExing a lot of drives in the last few months. Recently, our institution set up, or had all along, but we didn't know about it, an rsync server for which they can give us temporary accounts for our collaborators. And it's not particularly fast, but the nice thing is you just start it running, and then maybe, you know, a few days later, they've got their data. And if you compress your movies using, you know, your non-gain-corrected movies, which are mostly integers, using TIFF, LZW, you get very good compression. And that's, I think that's reasonable, at least if it's a collaboration where you need to send them, like, one data set a month, I think that's all right.
Any other comments? All right, well, let's thank Dan. Steve's going to talk about what you could do.
I don't think that's what I'm going to talk about. I think Holger and I sort of swapped roles. I view Holger's setup as the pie in the sky setup. So. Everyone hear me? Yeah? Now? All right. Thanks. So, yeah, if you have some dedicated programmers and you have a lot of money to buy big computers, you can afford to do GPU sorts of things and be really up to date with everything. But I think most people don't. So I'm going to be, I think, probably a little more practical-minded. You know, how would a center sort of maintain their computational resources over years? Because you can't just look at, oh, I have $1 million, I'm going to buy a computer right now, and then I won't have any money for the next 10 years. That just, you know, it's not a viable strategy. So in addition to being the co-director of WAS, a P41 center, which means we have a lot of data and a lot of processing, I also co-direct something at Baylor called the Cyber Center, which is basically a group of PIs that got together. Some of them do simulations, some of them do genomics, and some of them do image processing. And we all needed computers, which our institution was not providing, basically, in a reasonable way. And basically, we run sort of a little co-op. And the institution gives us about $100,000 a year for hardware, and that sort of seeds things, and then the PIs contribute money, and then we buy whatever, you know, however much money we get each year, we buy some clusters, and that sort of keeps us rolling every year. So clusters become sort of semi-obsolete after about 3 years, and by the time you hit 5 or 6 years, it's no longer cost-effective to fix them when they break. So basically our approach is we buy clusters, we get the manufacturers to give us a 3-year warranty on it, then anything that breaks after that 3-year period, unless it's something really trivial, we just let that node die, and then it gradually sort of degrades over time, and then after about 6 years, we retire it, and we're continuously sort of buying new. So that system, that setup, has about 50 to 60 users at a time. Right now, we've got about 2,500 cores and 5 clusters. It's not a really big operation, and it usually operates at about a 70 to 80% load level. So we view this as sort of a supplement to things like the NSF, in the U.S. anyway, where you can get access to free compute time. But on a cluster like this, you can get access sort of immediately. You don't have to wait for your jobs to queue up for a week. You can always get access to a sort of a small amount of computation.
just as an example to think about in context here, that 20,000 ribosome particle data set that Shor has made publicly available takes about 1,000 CPU hours to process in EMAN2 and about 10 times as much in Reliant. But if you're looking at problems that aren't easy like that, you know, not, you don't have really good data that you're processing heterogeneous data, you're processing other stuff, you can easily run into cases where a project will use 10 to 100 times that much. So if you look at our center, which is about 35 people, I just added it up, we use about 5 million CPU hours a year total. You know, that's among all those people. And that's mostly EMAN processing, so that this is where the factor of 10 actually comes into play. That would be 50 million CPU hours if we did everything in say, Reliant. And if you look at, say, the Amazon, you know, cloud, if you wanted to use cloud computing, they charge about 10 cents per CPU hour of the sort of CPU hours I'm talking about here. So I'm saying, you know, if we bought our computing from the cloud, we'd be talking about $500,000 a year in compute expenses. And if we were 10 times more of that, we don't have the budget for 5 million a year. So it's really a cost issue. Now, of course, cloud computing is a lot more expensive than what we do in-house, so we'll talk about that. So this is very similar to what you've seen in some of the other slides. These are the things you have to keep in mind. What processor do you buy? How much memory do you need on each processor? What sort of interconnect do you want to use? How are you going to store all of this data? I mentioned Lustre here. We saw another option there as well. There are disadvantages to using these distributed file systems, which are if one of your nodes goes down, suddenly all of the storage in your cluster can become unusable for periods of time. So if you want to use one of these sort of high-performance distributed file systems, you really have to have very good system maintenance, which, again, is expensive. A good single system administrator may cost you $80,000 or $100,000 a year, which is a pretty substantial expense. So let me start with this. You should get a good workstation. So instead of doing sort of what Holger has done, which is a fine approach for his situation, I espouse the idea that you should buy one or more nice workstations, which can either be dedicated to a specific person or you can share them in your lab or whatever. They cost under $10,000 each. You can get them down to about $5,000 or as much as about $10,000. You put your GPU in there for doing things like frame alignment and stuff like that, where it's fairly inexpensive. You can buy a consumer-grade GPU card. You don't have to buy the $5,000 card. You can buy the $500 card and get perfectly adequate performance out of it in most cases. People may disagree on that point, I don't know. You can get 128, 256 gigs of RAM, and you can put a whole bunch of storage in it, and that way, you can get 1.2 to 1.5 gigabytes per second of storage bandwidth just dedicated to that workstation. So as Holger said, he can get 2 gigabytes per second of bandwidth to his file system, but that's shared over the whole cluster. So if 10 people are trying to do that simultaneously, they're only getting about 200 megabytes per second each. Now, that's not strictly true. If you use something like Lustre, like I mentioned on the other page, all of the nodes of the cluster can simultaneously get about 100 megabytes or 150 megabytes a second. But here you can really get, if you're trying to do movie mode processing or something, that 1.2 gigabytes per second just on that computer is really important. And with 24 cores, that's actually a substantial amount of computing. So that will give you 200,000 CPU hours per year just on that machine. Now, of course, that means you have to be processing on that machine all year to get that. You can't concentrate it, but it gives you an idea of how much power you're talking about. All right, now let me switch gears a little bit and talk about an actual cluster. So if I said right now I wanted to buy a cluster, and we're going to be buying another one for this year in the next couple of months, so I have pretty up-to-date numbers, this is basically what I would tell people to buy. So you can buy these 2U. A U is a unit of height in a rack mounting system. So a typical rack is 44U high. So a 2U node, you could cram 22 of them into one of these standard racks. So a single 2U compute chassis can fit 4 nodes in it. And each of those nodes can have 2 processors, and each processor can have a bunch of cores. So you can cram quite a lot of computation. One of these 2U boxes, that means you get, so 4 nodes, 8 CPUs, you get almost 100 cores in a single 2U box. The density of computation has just gone up massively over the last few years. When we built the computer center that we put this hardware in, it was designed for computers, you know, 7 or 8 years ago, and literally the density of the computers is about 5 or 6 times higher now. So there's all sorts of concerns with cooling and that sort of thing. How do you cool something that's concentrated? Anyways, you have some choice of sort of which processors you put in there to sort of balance things, but the CPU, Intel and AMD know exactly how all the economics of this work out. It turns out that if you buy more cores versus less cores or a higher speed versus a lower speed, you pay almost the same price per unit of computation, regardless of what choice you make. There's a bit of a premium as you increase the number of processors per node. So over a wide range of values, it's almost flat. And then if you try to put a whole bunch of processors on one node, there's a premium price that you pay for that. But you can't look at it as the cost per CPU because, it, you know, 2 gigahertz CPU versus 3 gigahertz CPU, it really is about a 50% difference in processing speed for image processing. I would normally say about 128 gigabytes per node, but the more processors you put in, the more memory you might want to put in there. Holger was talking about QDR InfiniBand. FDR is now the standard. It's a little bit faster, but you don't need to get that sort of massively interconnected setup. If you do your pre-processing on these standalone computers in the lab, then you don't need to have your cluster nearly as tightly interconnected, particularly if you're not doing GPU computation. So you can set up a singly interconnected InfiniBand network, and you can get very nice performance out of it. It's not all that expensive. We usually put about 4 terabyte local scratch hard drives in each node. Then if you want to link them all together with like a Lustre file system or something like that, you can aggregate the storage for high-speed scratch space. But normally, we buy a separate storage node, and then that gets distributed, that storage gets distributed among the nodes. While cryo-EM, for movie mode processing, you need to have really high bandwidth. But once you get beyond the movie mode processing, usually the storage bandwidth isn't the limiting factor. You need high bandwidth, but usually for short bursts of time. So it usually balances out pretty nicely. And one of these nodes, just one of these 2U boxes, uses about 2 kilowatts. It's rated for 2 kilowatts. It actually usually draws about 1 kilowatt. Now a head node, for each cluster you'll usually have one head node, which controls everything else that goes on in the cluster. That'll cost about 38,000, which is comparable to the cost of the one of these compute nodes. This will normally only have one node in the box instead of 4 nodes in the box. But then you can build your storage directly into this node. So if you buy a head node, you can get very easily 168 terabytes of storage in this one head node box, and it's directly connected to the head node. So you can get about 2 gigabytes per second throughput to that storage. And then you can distribute it to the nodes in the cluster. Now, this sort of argues for not making an individual cluster too big. If you put too many nodes in, then it's sharing a lot of this bandwidth and other resources, and then you also have to buy a lot more InfiniBand switches to interconnect things. So it's not actually a bad strategy. If we add up all the costs, the cluster I'm talking about here is about $750,000. If I had $2 million to spend, instead of buying one giant cluster for $2 million, I would probably buy 3 individual smaller clusters because that allows you to get much better control over the bandwidth and balancing of the loads and stuff. The only case you'd need to have the one giant cluster is if you really need to use all the nodes at one time for a single project. And for us, with 30 or 40 users, we can already balance the load easily that way. So one of these $750,000 clusters, that's one rack. Okay, so we're talking about a single rack. That you could put in a computer center somewhere, draws about 20 kilowatts of power. Okay, that's the equivalent of about a block worth of residential houses. Okay, so that's something to keep in mind. And that means that, so that's about 20 kilowatts of draw, then you have to pump all the heat out, so then you have to roughly double that to take into account cooling costs and that sort of thing. You can work it out. Typically, about 1 watt over a year is about $1 at typical electricity prices, at least in the U.S. That's about 10 to 12 cents per kilowatt hour. So that means that the cost to run that one rack in electricity each year is $30,000 to $40,000 a year. Usually, your institution pays that for you, and you don't have to worry about it, but it's something to be aware of, at least. So that one rack will give you about 15 million CPU hours per year. If you think about it, if you go to, you know, like one of the, you know, NSF computing centers and you apply for an allocation there, they will typically give you, pretty easily give you an allocation of about 200,000 service units. And one of their service units is roughly equal to the CPU hours that I'm talking about here. Okay? So one of these racks is giving you quite a lot more than that. If you are talking about using millions of CPU hours, you can get those allocations for free from places like the NSF, but that's a much bigger application. It's like writing a grant. If you add all this up, it's a nice little computer in a fairly small form factor, and as I say, we don't usually have $750,000 a year. Usually, we're spending more like $200,000 to $250,000 a year, but then we always, each year we're buying a new small amount of hardware and keeping things current. Just some other things to think about. There's a choice between Intel and AMD processors. People often look at the prices and they say, wow, the AMD processors are like 50% less or 30% less expensive. That's because they're 30% slower. You can't just look at the clock rate. The AMD processors have fewer floating point operations at a time for image processing and stuff. Cost-wise, Intel's a little bit more cost-effective, but the number of cores is not just, you can't just look at the number of cores. The NVIDIA processing, there's another option, which is the Intel Phi processors, or Phi processors, however you want to pronounce it. The difference is that with a Tesla, you have to program everything for this CUDA language, which keeps evolving with time, and it's, as Holger said, it's very difficult to keep things up to date and working. Intel is trying to do this Phi thing where they have a bunch of not very powerful processors, but processors that use the same instruction set as the normal Intel processors, so you don't have to reprogram everything to make use of them. I would say it's still pretty early days, but if you look at the latest cluster that the NSF purchased for the supercomputing program, the Stampede cluster at UT Austin, that has these Phi processors installed. So I think things are beginning to sort of shift away from GPUs and towards more, yeah?
Really accurate that the Phi doesn't require reprogramming. My understanding is that they do have some...
No, you're right. No, you do have to do a little bit of stuff, but it's nothing like what you have to do in CUDA.
Right.
No,
I was under the same impression that, okay, I'll take, whatever, free align or run it in there, but actually it's not, apparently it's not the case.
I don't have much experience with them yet either. I'm not encouraging people to go out and buy them right now. I think it's too early to tell where things are going to go. And all of these things require a lot of personnel investment to make work.
That's the other question I have. So are you going to factor in the maintenance in terms of stuff that is required?
I think I have a little bit on that in the next slide, yeah, or another slide. InfiniBand switches are usually limited to 36 or 44 nodes each. That's another reason why you might want to limit the size of your clusters. As soon as you have to go to two or more switches, then if you want to really have things interconnected properly, you need a lot more work. So anyway, if you talk about the cloud costs something like 8 to 12 cents per CPU hour. If you build a cluster like this and you don't have to pay for the electricity and you don't have to pay for the system administration and stuff, it's about 1.5 cents per CPU hour. Once you factor in the power and having at least some basic level of system administration and stuff like that, it goes up to about 2 cents per CPU hour. So it's about 5 times less than you'd pay for computing in the cloud, and then you don't have to worry about transferring the data there. So I get time for free from other agencies or your institution or whatever, certainly if you can, but paying for time in the cloud doesn't make a lot of sense unless your usage is very bursty. Storage is the other issue. I just thought I'd also throw in an example here of large data storage. So you can get about 378 this is an example of building a storage unit that has 378 terabytes of storage in a rack, basically. So you have a single four-year computer which has can fit 36 hard drives in it. You can now get 6 terabyte hard drives, and then you can attach one of these 45-unit auxiliary units to that. And run it all through a single computer. So that basically gives you 378 terabytes in a single pair of boxes that you can mount in a rack. And the only limiting factor there is this is designed sort of for cheap, long-term storage. The total bandwidth you get out of that's going to be 1.5 to 2 gigabytes per second. If you make, if you say set up five of these boxes, then of course you have an aggregate bandwidth that's higher. So you have to sort of balance how much bandwidth you need versus how much total storage you need when you're when you're doing these things. But again, costs are much lower using a strategy like this. So the cost for storage in this setup right now is about 0.25 cents per gigabyte month. And if you look at the cost that, I think that's the next thing, cloud storage right now, it's about 10 to 20 times higher than that for archival storage. Now, the difference is, if you just buy one of these, you've got RAID 6 storage, which gives you a little redundancy. If when a hard drive fails, you can swap the drives out and, you know, you'll be okay. But if you have some sort of catastrophic failure, your data's gone. So really, if you want to set up something that's as redundant as the cloud storage is, because they sort of guarantee 99.9999% recovery, you need to at least set up a redundant system. So you have two of these for your data storage, hopefully in two different sites, and that doubles your costs. And then if you want to add a tape backup system or something as well, that's another 50% to your costs. But still, you're talking about something that's substantially less expensive than putting it in the cloud, assuming you have some place to put it. Else? Yeah, I think that was
your
cab
is here.
Yeah. Okay. Also, any questions?
What? And you guys will put your give us our slides and we'll put them on the workshop website. I think that would be great. Well, let's thank Steve and Dan both.
We can take a question or two, right? Or I don't know. My flight's not for a little while, but I did.
This is for Steve. What about proprietary compilers?
About what?
What about proprietary compilers for clusters? Like buying compilers, like are you just, do you notice any speed ups on your clusters? Are you using Intel compilers or Portland Group or anything?
Using different compilers.
Proprietary.
We experimented with it a while ago. You can get variations of as much as 10 or 15% sometimes by playing with different compilers. It's often a big pain to get it set up and really distributed properly across the whole cluster unless you're using a really professionally managed cluster. Most of the time, people don't really bother. I mean, that's one of the things, like if you download the Eman binaries, they're about 25% slower than they could be if you optimized it for the specific computer in many cases. So if you just compiling from source using the new compilers will get you, a significant speed boost over the binaries which will run on any computer out there. One comment or one question.
So one thing is that the data storage long term also that it's an issue. I don't know how you like to hear what your solution there, but also the cost actually for every project is actually became substantial. Really like your chemical consumable, whatever way your hard disk or your tape or whatever way. When you're writing an Scrum, then this should be built in as a consumable now, like 5 or 10,000 a year, and then just for long-term storage. But then I'd like to hear what's your solution for.
You have to consider these things when you're writing. So with a P41 center, 100,000 a year is still a pretty substantial chunk of the center expenses. So that's not, we're managing to get a little bit of money from the institution effectively through this money that they're putting in. We're getting money from other grants which are contributing and stuff like that. So, we could manage to cover that sort of level of expense, but Well, all right, storage costs go down with time. So, our long-term storage is just in these big RAID arrays, basically. Yeah.
You don't archive anything to tape?
Tape is not really cost-effective. It varies, right? It was not cost-effective, then it is, then it isn't, then it is. But tape is fairly unreliable and stuff. We often will just put, if we want a tape-like backup, we just put hard drives stacked on a shelf. It's not good for 20 years, but it's okay for 10 years.
I think we should probably get these guys.
You need to go.
Yeah, we should.
Hey, thanks, everybody. Great meeting. And if you get a chance, you should go and say thank you to Lorraine and Linnell, who did a great job of organizing, and to Sargis, who's been trapped in that projection box all week. So thank you, Sargis.
And Nancy's out there, too. She's kind of arranged all the catering and all that. So thanks.
Grab a box lunch and take off.
Thanks, everyone, for their participation. You make it work.